Part 1. Trial by Ordeal. Chapter 1. The Count and the Imam. He perceived two means by which he would profit, one for his soul and the other for his material benefit. Count Roger of Sicily lifted his leg and farted. "By the truth of my religion," he exclaimed, "there is more use in that than in what you have to say." His advisers stood chastened and a little perplexed. The count before them was in his late 40s and salted to his bones with the experience of military campaigning in southern Italy and the islands of the central Mediterranean. As a young warrior, he had been described by one flatterer as tall and well-made, a most fluent speaker, shrewd in counsel, far-sighted in the planning of things to be done, cheerful and pleasant to everyone. In middle age, he had hardened somewhat and was not one to waste his words on fools. The plan the advisers had recommended had seemed like a good one, as courtiers' plans very often do before they are shredded by the critiques of short-tempered potentates. Not far across the sea from Sicily, roughly 75 miles or 120 kilometres at the closest point, lay the remains of what had, in ancient times, been called Carthage, afterwards the Roman province of Africa, and now, in the late 11th century, Ifriqiya. Its cities, including the capital Mahdia, on the coast, and Karouan, inland, where a vast mosque and school had for many generations been frequented by the greatest philosophers and natural scientists in North Africa, were under the shaky command of a crumbling dynasty of Berber Muslims known as the Zirids. The countryside was controlled by various Arab Bedouin tribes sent from Egypt to drive the Zirids out. Political stability was collapsing. Here lay warm and fertile farmlands, there sat prosperous port towns. All ripe for the taking? Roger's councillors thought so, and they had therefore recommended to their testy overlord the proposal of a cousin whom one source names only as Baldwin. This Baldwin had come into possession of a great army of Christian soldiers and was casting around for somewhere godless to conquer. He had asked Roger's blessing to come to Sicily and use it as a launch pad for an invasion of Ifriqiya. "I shall be a neighbour of yours," he had exclaimed, as though this were good news. But Roger of Sicily was not feeling neighbourly. Ifriqiya was undoubtedly ruled by various followers of Islam, he said, but those infidels happened to be sworn partners of the Sicilians in agreements that kept the peace and allowed for a rich exchange of goods in the island's markets and ports. The last thing he wanted, he ranted to his gathered minions, was a cousin imposing on his hospitality, waging a reckless war that would disrupt Sicilian trade if it was successful, and cost him a lot of money in military support if it failed. Ifriqiya may indeed have been vulnerable, but if anyone was going to exploit that, it was going to be Roger himself. He had spent the last 2.5 decades, almost his entire adult life, carving out his rule in the region, and it would have been a limp end indeed if he were now to put it at risk in pursuit of some hare-brained scheme cooked up by a kinsman who had never troubled the soil of the island with his sweat. If this Baldwin wanted to fight Muslims, said Roger, he would have to find a different part of the Mediterranean in which to go about his business. There were plenty of places he could name that would be preferable to Sicily's backyard. He summoned Baldwin's personal envoy to his presence and informed him of his decision. If his master were really serious, he said, then the best way to proceed is to conquer Jerusalem. And that is how it all began. Roger, Count of Sicily, was 11th century Europe's ultimate self-made man. He was born around the year 1040 as the youngest of 12 sons sired by a minor nobleman from Normandy called Tancred of Hauteville. Given the protocols of inheritance, being born even as a second son implied a lifelong burden of fortune hunting rather than easy inheritance, To have 11 brothers ahead of you was a disaster. But by the end of the century, the Normans had begun to conquer their way around Western Europe. They took command of Saxon England in 1066. At the same time, southern Italy fell under their gaze. Opportunities may have been limited for younger sons within Normandy itself, but for anyone prepared to travel, opportunity abounded. As a young man, therefore, Roger had left his homelands in what is now northwest France and set out for territory that had already called many of his kinsmen and countrymen, the rich but unstable southern Italian regions of Calabria and Apulia. Toe and heel of the Italian boot, Calabria and Apulia were lands where resources were plentiful, authority was contested, and an ambitious young man with a yen for politics and warfare might make his name. Other Normans of the Hauteville clan had already found success here, fighting against the rival superpowers in the region, principally the Byzantine Greeks and Roman popes, both of whom regarded the Normans with suspicion bordering on alarm. The most successful of them included Roger's brothers, William Ironarm, Drogo, and the exceptionally gifted Robert Guiscard. In Old French, Guichard means cunning or sly. By the time Roger arrived, the first two were dead, and Robert Guiscard had laid claim to the title of Count of Apulia and Calabria. But there were plenty of adventures to be found. The family had earned the submission of the people of southern Italy by chopping off their noses, hands, and feet, and gouging out their eyes. The Normans' tribal history told of their descent from a Scandinavian warlord called Rollo, who had converted to Christianity mainly as a means of ensuring that men of all manner of kingdoms would bend their knee to his command. Neither Roger nor Robert ever lost the Viking touch for persuasion at the end of a sword. Thanks in large part to this reputation for extravagant violence, not everyone approved of the Norman invasion of southern Italy. In the opinion of one eminent churchman of the age, the Normans were the most foul-smelling rubbish in the world, sons of filth, tyrants who have risen from the rabble. But from the middle of the century onwards, the papacy took a different view, as successive popes softened their hostility to the Normans and began to view them as rough-edged but practically useful potential allies, who could be employed to advance the agenda of Rome. In part, the papacy reached this conclusion under duress. In 1053, the Normans had destroyed a papal army on the battlefield and taken Nicholas's predecessor, Pope Leo IX, prisoner. Be that as it may, in 1059, Pope Nicholas II nevertheless granted the Hauteville family sway over Calabria and Apulia and permitted them to fly a papal banner before their armies on the battlefield, an honour he bestowed upon Robert Guiscard in exchange for a gift of 4 camels. And this was not just an acceptance of the status quo. The Pope speculated that one day one of the Norman clan might, with the help of God and St. Peter, also conquer and rule Sicily, the large triangular island across the Straits of Messina that had been under Arab rule since the 9th century. This would represent a major advance in papal ambitions to bring the whole of southern Italy firmly under the sway of the Roman Church. If the Normans could do that, ran the reasoning, then all the disruption caused on the mainland in the many decades since the arrival of these rough-necked northerners might just have been worth it. The conquest of Sicily appealed strongly to Roger and his brother Robert Guiscard, although not quite for the same reasons as it appealed to the Pope. Pleasing God could quite satisfactorily be done locally by founding and maintaining communities of monks and nuns, praising Christ and observing the saints' feast days. Fighting an expeditionary war to seize and subjugate an island 1,000 square miles or 2,500 square kilometres in size, with a coastal length of nearly 930 miles or 1,500 kilometres, and a large region of volcanic mountains in its centre, was an act of piety that required more substantial, earthly justification. Fortunately, on Sicily there were plenty of reasons to be found. Wet in the winter and hot in the summer, the island contained some of the finest farmland in the Mediterranean, producing prodigious quantities of grain by agricultural methods much improved under the rule of its Islamic emirs. Rice, lemons, dates and sugarcane thrived. Sicilian workshops produced cotton and papyrus. Calm waters kept fishermen busy. Pilgrim tourists from Muslim-ruled southern Spain stopped for refreshment as they headed to Mecca to perform Hajj. Coastal towns including Palermo, Syracuse, Catania, Messina and Agrigento were hub marketplaces in the central Mediterranean, where merchants from the Middle East and Northeast Africa could do business with those working trade routes through Central and Western Europe. The local population, comprising Arab and Berber Muslims, Greek Orthodox Christians and Jews, represented a lucrative tax base, as the emirs had demonstrated by following the Islamic practice of imposing an infidel tax known as jizya on those non-Muslims who did not wish to convert. All this being so, the papal hymn of Sicilian conquest sung to Roger and Robert Guiscard in 1059 made a lot of sense. As a Sicilian monastic chronicler called Geoffrey Malaterra told the story, when that most distinguished young man Roger heard that Sicily was in the hands of the unbelievers, he was seized by the desire to capture it. He perceived two means by which he would profit, one for his soul and the other for his material benefit. If he could bring over to divine worship a country given over to idolatry. Money and immortality. These two timeless temptations proved more than enough to coax Roger and Robert Guiscard across the Straits of Messina in a series of invasions beginning in the early 1060s. Taking Sicily from the Arabs was neither easy nor quick, but when the Norman brothers focused their full attention, bringing naval blockades and warriors who were small in number but expert in the Norman style of fighting, with light armour and heavy cavalry, large wooden shields and siege towers, they proved very difficult to resist. They exploited the rivalries of Islamic factions on the island, who had at times in the past hired Christian mercenaries from mainland Italy and were more than willing to collaborate with the Norman armies to further their own ambitions for political supremacy. They indulged in base but effective psychological warfare, raping their enemies' wives or sending carrier pigeons soaked in blood to announce their victories. As a result, Palermo fell in 1072, following a five-month siege. By the mid-1080s, most of the island was under Norman command. The inveterate adventurer Robert Guiscard left to seek further excitement fighting in the Byzantine Empire, pushing Norman rule into Dalmatia, Macedonia and Thessaly, and leaving his younger brother Roger to rule more or less as he pleased as Count of Sicily. By 1091, the conquest of Sicily was complete, and Roger was revelling in his role as one of Europe's most admired Christian overlords, entertaining marriage proposals for his daughters from the kings of France, Germany and Hungary, establishing bishoprics across the island that were obedient to the papacy rather than the eastern patriarchs of the Orthodox Church, and overseeing a population that remained as richly variegated between faiths and cultures as it had ever been. Roger built and patronised churches and monasteries on Sicily, an act of conventional piety for any ruler of the age, particularly one who had an awkward amount of human blood on his hands. The mosque in Palermo, originally built as a Byzantine basilica, was converted once again, this time into a church observant of the Latin rite. On occasion, he seems to have forced defeated Muslim rivals to convert to Christianity. The jizya system was effectively reversed, so that Muslims rather than Christians now paid a tax, the censum or tributum, for the right to their unbelief. Jews also paid a tallage. But Roger was in no sense creating a theocracy. Indeed, visiting churchmen from further north in Europe tut-tutted at the fact that Roger not only allowed Muslims to serve in his armies, but, so they said, actively refused to allow them to convert to the cause of Christ. And the Count himself was pragmatic more often than he was dogmatic when he presented himself to his subjects. Copper coins known as trifolari, minted for use by his Christian subjects, showed Roger as a glorious Christian knight on horseback, carrying a holy lance, and were inscribed in Latin with his name, Count Roger, Roquerius Comes. Yet each gold tari, a coin minted for use by his Muslim subjects, carried an Arabic inscription. There is no God but Allah. Muhammad is the prophet of Allah. Others of Roger's Arabic coins and his charters in the same language referred to him variously as Imam, Malik and Sultan, Lord, Sovereign and King. What, though, are we to make of the perplexing story of Roger's refusal to extend his success in Sicily by sponsoring an invasion of Ifriqiya? The tale comes down to us via a scholar called Ibn al-Athir, who lived and died in Mosul, today in Iraq, between 1160 and 1233, and whose masterpiece was a magisterial chronicle confidently entitled Al-Kamil fil Tariq, The Perfect Work of History. Ibn al-Athir was a serious historian who devoted hundreds of thousands of words to a story of the world, beginning with the creation and continuing up to the political and military struggles of and between the wider Islamic world in his own lifetime, upon which he cast a panoptic and often highly insightful gaze. Given the age through which he had lived, crusaders and their motives were naturally high among his interests, and he gave serious thought to the origins of the holy wars that flared up spectacularly and often around the Mediterranean basin during his lifetime. His decision to place the responsibility at the door of Roger of Sicily, whom he characterises as coarse, smelly and cynical, the very archetype of the Crusader Lord, is important, even if it should not be taken wholly at face value. The character of Baldwin is probably meant to signal Baldwin I, future king of Jerusalem, but there is no corroborating evidence that this exchange happened. Possibly, Ibn al-Athir, in his account, was conflating what he knew with hindsight of the origins of the Crusades in the Holy Land with a particular story of more local origin and flavour. In 1087, according to the chronicler Malaterra, Ifriqiya had come under amphibious attack from an army raised by merchants from Pisa, who had set out to do business in Africa only to suffer certain injuries. In a much less grotesque and colourful telling than Ibn al-Athir's, Malaterra simply says that the Pisans offered to award Roger the crown of Ifriqiya if he would help them take the city of Mardia. Roger demurred, on the ground that he had only relatively recently agreed a peace treaty with the authorities there. He made no mention of Jerusalem. According to Malaterra, the Pisans made their own deal with the Zirid ruler and accepted a cash payment to leave Mardia alone. Yet there is more to it than that still. When Ibn al-Athir introduces his story about Count Roger and the state of Ifriqiya, he does so by setting it in a broad Mediterranean context. At around the same time that the Normans were conquering Sicily and menacing the coast of Ifriqiya, he wrote, they also took the city of Toledo and other cities of Spain. Later they took other parts, as you shall see. And indeed so they did. In Spain, North Africa, the islands of the Mediterranean, and elsewhere, clashes between rival rulers, obedient to different faiths, were commonplace during the decades before the First Crusade began. These were not wars of religion. Indeed, religion was often very plainly secondary to commercial and geopolitical considerations. But they were wars between religious men, and they had consequences that lasted for generations thereafter, so that they could still be seen to be playing out in Ibn al-Athir's day. The collapsing together of wars fought for territory and wars that were waged on the basis of faith and dogma, with the goal of spiritual supremacy, was to play a key part in launching 200 years and more of conflict that would come to be expressed primarily in terms of a battle for the one true faith.